Okay, folks, welcome to the latest edition of Planet Porky, the podcast that comes to you from celestial areas of the universe, places you haven't been before, and we're going to take you to those places you would always like to have been at. Delighted, of course, to say, with me again today, my broadcasting partner and enfantesse terrible, Leslie Ann Jones.
Against all the odds, by unpopular demand,
she's back. She is back indeed. It's good to see you. And listen, let's kick off with something that's very topical, because I was messaging you last night after I switched on the One Show, a BBC show that comes on at 7 o'clock, comes in for a bit of criticism sometimes, but wow, what a guest they had on when I turned on last night. Al Pacino.
Alfredo? I didn't see it. But
no.
You know, you were raving on Twitter about...
Yeah, absolutely. The greatest living actor and all this kind of stuff.
As a screen idol and so on.
He
doesn't look that bloody good.
Oh, it's fantastic. He's nearly 80. I think he's 80 on Friday.
Stringy hair.
But doesn't matter, he's still got hair. No. He's got more hair than me. And I'm only entering early middle age. He looks better than me.
No, I wouldn't touch him with yours.
You said that in a message last night. I thought that was rather harsh. Why do you say this?
I don't find him sexy.
You don't find him sexy? Didn't you find him sexy in Godfather 2?
No, I don't like violent
Michael
films.
Michael Corleone.
Lassie is about as violent as I get.
Right.
But in Scent of a Woman, he was magnificent.
Yes.
And was that the film when he was blind and he drove
Ferrari.
Yeah, drove the Ferrari at 100 miles an hour.
I only just got started. Yeah,
which
that
was fantastic.
One of the
it reminded me
yeah.
of a time in the States shortly after my father fell under a train and lost his arm.
Oh, no, it was very tragic, yes.
But it didn't stop him. You know, he soldiered on and he did carry on driving.
Yes,
for a long
your father
time.
Did.
Yeah, and he was driving in Arizona, actually.
Well, would they rent a car to a guy with only one arm?
Because he carried a little device that you clipped to the steering wheel.
Oh, I see.
And it sort of assists the steering,
right,
if you
okay,
like.
Okay, yeah.
So there he is, bombing along.
Yeah,
you know,
the one-arm driver.
Breaking the speed limit.
Yeah, yeah.
And sitting in the other side of the car, of course, his right arm is missing.
Right.
And as the cop pulled him over,
yes,
my father wound down the window and lent his stump.
Yeah.
On the window frame.
Right.
The cop was so shocked, he just went, okay, you can go.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. He probably thought he might have come across a bank robber or something who's just had his arm blown off or whatever.
But Pacino, hard man, isn't he?
Oh, well, we met him once in New York, right? And the girl I was going out with at the time, whose name, amazingly, and she was a Jewish-American princess, okay, in New York, came from the Bronx, you know, I'm going to go bananas, you know, and all that kind of stuff. She was, I mean, very, very typical New Yorker. And her name was Jane Seaman, can you believe?
Okay.
And, you know, she'd been around the sort of the English newspaper scene for a good number of years. And I went with Jane to see Pacino. He was something like the preview to a Broadway play he was doing or something like that. You know what I mean? But, I mean, he is such a hero in New York in particular. You know, she almost fainted. And, her legs went, weak when she saw Pacino and people had to hold her up and all that kind of stuff. That's the sort of effect he had on people.
The thing is, though... Yeah. And I always have to say this,
yes,
that people fall for the screen persona,
yes,
for the characters whom they play.
Yes.
And those guys are not those guys.
Yeah, but
whenever
I've seen Pacino being interviewed or heard him or read anything about him, he's very, very similar to the characters he's played in films.
Well, then maybe he's playing the part. Still.
Maybe he is. You know, yeah. I mean, he
so
is a New Yorker.
Playing the character, playing the character.
All the interviews I've ever seen him do, I've always had a backdrop of something fantastic in New York. I think the last one was the Brooklyn Bridge. You know, very iconic and all that kind
he's
of stuff.
He's quite small, though, isn't he?
Yeah, he's quite small.
He wears lifts in his shoes.
Does he? Yeah,
and that is going to be a complete turn off for me from the start.
Yeah, but anyway, look, now talking about famous people, of course, what I want to talk to you about, because, of course, you are rock chick writer extraordinaire. Well, what about this revelation that not only was Bill Wyman associating with underage girls, and Mandy Smith, of course, was very famously the 13-year-old, and in in Bill Wyman's defence, he actually walked into a police station years later and said, do you want to talk to me or see me?
It doesn't make him innocent.
It doesn't.
I have tried to explain this.
Yes, you have.
Millions of times.
Yes.
So what it required was somebody to make a formal complaint against Bill Wyman to the Metropolitan Police or the Crown Prosecution Service.
Yes.
And no one did.
Nobody
Without
did.
Something to go on, they cannot just arrest somebody on hearsay.
No.
So Wyman walked free because Mandy didn't make a complaint.
Absolutely.
Here we have Ray Dawn Chong claiming to have had sex with Mick Jagger when she was 15,
which
makes Mick Jagger a paedophile. If this is true, then he, like Bill Wyman, will be a paedophile.
Well,
now, we have a thing called the age of consent.
Yes.
The age of consent is in place to protect young women from themselves just as much as from predators. So she could not have consented to sex with Mick Jagger at the age of 15 because she was underage. She could not consent.
Yeah.
Therefore, her parents need to be in jail, and so does he.
You think so? Yeah.
Yes, I do. I feel really strongly about this.
I was living in New York in the years when this is supposed to have happened, okay? So the headline I see from a Sunday newspaper, she was a 15-year-old schoolgirl, Mick was 33, and married to Bianca. I can't remember Mick Jagger as 33. I really can't.
He's always been 75,
absolutely.
He looks like he's been in a microwave.
But he does, yeah. Now, I remember it when I was in New York in those days, he was trying to become a solo singer, right? You know, people like...
And a film star.
And a film star, you're right. Yeah, but people like Rod Stewart had broken away from the Faces years before. Brian Ferry had broken away from his band, and they had great solo careers. And so Mick made this song called Just Another Night. Give me just another night, just another night with you. And it was hopeless.
You just see the gestures here.
Yeah, but the minute I heard it, I thought, I won't get anywhere. And I think Keith Richard took the mickey out of him, it being a pathetic song without his bandmates.
Mick has never been anything without the Stones. The whole caricature, needs all the parts, doesn't it?
It does. But the reason I mention this is because this lady, whose name was Ray Dawn, Ray Dawn Chong.
Ray Dawn Chong.
Yeah.
Very pretty lady.
She was the girl in the 1985 video for that song, Just Another Night. And
you probably think this song is about me, don't you?
That's right. And she later complained that he was, quote, licky on the shoot.
Licky?
Yeah, what does that mean?
Can't you imagine?
Well, exactly, you know. And then goes on to say that her claim is that she slept with him, but Mick Jagger's made no comment on it, wouldn't expect him to, but all the information surrounding this is that, and she admits, I never told Mick Jagger my age, he never asked and I never told him.
That doesn't exonerate him. A very famous rock star who is a household name has said to me recently about the girls who used to pitch up at Top of the Pops.
Right.
On the recording days.
Yes, okay.
And he said to me quite openly, none of us was asking for birth certificates.
Well, I tell you something, that is a famous expression, and it was made by Max Clifford, right? I knew Max very well, I'm sure you did. Anybody in our business had to, didn't they, really? Far too well, exactly, that's what I mean. And I remember when it all started blowing up with pop stars being accused of, you know, consorting with underage girls. John Peel, you know, everybody thought he was a great guy, apparently.
14-year-old.
Had a thing for underage girls and all that. And when this all blew up and stars were being asked to go and talk to the police, I remember Max went on telly, as he always did, and he always wanted to do the interviews in the driveway of his £2 million home in Wentworth, OK, with a Rolls Royce parked behind
him. Look what I'm worth, everybody.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Max was a teetotaler, he didn't smoke, but he spent all his money on property. He had a villa in Marbella, and he had this house on, was it St George's Hill?
I never went there. It was a sleazy git, though, wasn't it?
Completely sleazy git, and turned me over many times, indeed. He turned a lot of people over.
10,000 showers wouldn't have cleansed him.
No, exactly. But he was standing there, giving this interview, thought he'd been very smart, and saying, you know, well, you know, in the 60s, you know, a lot of these girls throwing themselves at people, and nobody ever asked anybody's ages, and nobody told anybody their ages. And you know how he got caught out? He got caught out after a woman saw that interview, right? And she was 16, she was about 14 or 15 in the 60s, right? And she saw that and saw not a flicker of regret in his face and thought, no, hang on, you were procuring girls at that age for rock stars in those days. So she told the police. So the police thought there was enough evidence. They turned up at his place, right, went through his house and found a letter from that woman in his bedside drawer, which he'd kept.
Which he kept it.
Which he'd written years before.
What an idiot.
Asking him to make some sort of apology for the damage he'd done. And, I mean, you remember it all came out at his trial, how he would meet young ladies in hotels and they were all underage. And then he'd pretend that he'd just taken a phone call from an agent and he'd come back and say, you know, an agent walked through here 5 minutes ago. They saw me talking to you. They think you've got the look, you know, and there's a great career ahead of you. Just come and join me in a room I've booked upstairs and we can talk about it. And that's how he got caught out.
It always comes home to roost.
Yes.
And I would say that Mick Jagger is running scared right now. He's on very, very thin ice because if Ray
would
Dawn,
you really?
If she decides to make a formal complaint,
yeah, it's so long ago. Would anybody pick
matter.
Up on it?
Max Clifford's events were so long ago.
Oh, they were. They were 40 years
it
ago.
Doesn't matter. Yeah. Look at Paul Gambaccini. What he went through.
Yes, that's
those
right.
Those guys made it up. Of course, that never happened. But even so, it was a long time ago.
Yes,
and he was arrested for something he didn't do.
Yes.
So I would not be surprised. This woman, why has she come out with this now? She's probably broke. She probably needs money for something.
Why does she say? Ray Dawn, best known for a role in the 1985 action film Commando, which I have to say I've eminently forgot.
There you are.
Yeah,
but what a title.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Met the womanising rocker during a trip to New York. After their brief introduction, he whisked her to a recording studio before the pair spent the night together.
Of course.
Let's spend the night together. Now I need you more than ever. That was changed in America, wasn't it? To let's spend some time together.
So many lyrics were changed in America.
Yeah, because the Americans just wouldn't have anything that sounded
quite
seedy.
Sort of prudish in those days.
That's right. So this lady says, she says she's a thrice divorced 58-year-old grandmother. She said, he never asked me how old I was and I never told him. It never came up. I remember thinking he was really cute. He had tousled hair. I thought, oh man, this man is beautiful.
Well, she doesn't think that now. She's 58. She's thrice divorced. She's a grandmother.
Yep.
She's skint, right?
Well, she's sitting down in a hotel.
This is going to end up in court.
Bright lights of LA's infamous Sunset Strip in the background. And I think she was talking to your friend and mine, Caroline Graham. Because Caroline, of course, is the...
Good journalist.
Is a very good journalist and the West Coast correspondent of the Mail on Sunday. She says, to answer your question, she says she is only speaking out to own the story after accidentally blurting it out during a podcast, that's what we're doing now, by the way, during a podcast that she had sex with Jagger when she was 2 years under the age of consent. The podcast is due to air any day, and she wants to seize ownership and the intellectual property rights of that story.
Okay, so all it takes is for somebody in her familial circle to make a police complaint.
Yes.
And everybody ends up in court. Let's see where this one goes.
Yeah, well,
I think this is quite dangerous.
Do you?
Yes, I do.
I've now read it. I thought, well, it's a great story and all that.
And also, Mick used to like to make fun of Bill all the time because he was dating Mandy.
Right.
And there were all the jokes about, you know, Bill Wyman preferring...
Yes.
What does Bill Wyman have after dinner as a chocolate with his coffee?
Yes.
Underrates and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, underrates.
Dear
me, that's disgraceful.
I sense that this one is going to go far.
I always thought Bill Wyman was the most boring stone. I mean, the way he used to stand on the stage, rigid, like a block of stone.
Well, that's bass players. Don't forget, John Entwistle was the same. That's why they called him the Ox.
Right.
Who? Because you have to stand stock still.
Why?
The bass and the drums are the backbone of any
musical
performance.
Are they really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, Keith Richard climbs around on scaffolding when he's playing his guitar.
Yeah, but he's not a bass player.
No, of course he's not a bass player. Lead guitarist, I suppose.
Yeah, lead guitarist is different. They are flamboyant. They jump all over the place. But the bass guitarist
I'll take your
is
word
the
for
backbone
it.
Of the band, together with the drummer. Yeah.
I'll take your word for it. You know more about these things than I do. Now, have you ever been to Scotland?
Yeah, loads of times.
And why is that?
Work, play.
And do you have an affection for the country?
I really do, yes.
Yeah, I do as well. But unfortunately, I am persona non grata in Scotland this week.
Why,
okay.
What have you done?
Oh, I'm under siege, believe me, from the Scots, because I did a TV show earlier this week. Did Jeremy Vine on Five, right? And we were talking post-Brexit. It was the first show that Jeremy had done since we came out of the European Union, the Friday before.
Yeah.
And the matter of Scottish independence came up, you know. What's Wee Bernie's name? Wee Bernie, the leader of the Scots up there.
Yeah.
I've forgotten the name.
Yeah,
now.
We're old. We don't remember.
Well, I will in a minute, yeah. But anyway, the point is, I just made a throwaway comment. And I said, look, before we get on to independence for Scotland, can somebody tell me, please, how on earth are the Scots going to fund themselves if they become independent? I said, Scotland hasn't got any money. And Jeremy said, what do you mean by that? I said, well, nearly 60% of the Scottish economy is funded from the UK, you know, from the southeast of England, from Whitehall. I said they've got a high percentage of people working for nationalised institutions and quangos and all that than anywhere else in the country. I said the oil is running out anyway, even if they manage to possess the oil. I said, what else have they got? A whiskey industry? That's not going to keep a country running, you know. And yeah. Jeremy said, oh, he said, funny you should say that. He said, I met a Scottish MP a few months ago and, you know, I had the same discussion with him, and he produced this note with all the industries in Scotland which will make billions, you know. I mean, like wind power and all this kind of stuff, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And
my view is, if they want independence this badly, let them have it. And let's see how they get on.
I don't want to see them fail. No, I like Scotland.
I think they'll come back. I love Scotland too, and I love the Scots. I have some very lovely Scottish friends.
And they've got fantastic culture that we haven't got in England.
Yes, they do, but they have fantastic culture all over Europe. And we are actually still Europeans.
Yes.
Geographically, we are. It's only a trade
money
thing.
Yes, that's true.
That we've pulled out of.
I totally agree. But anyway, the abuse I've had on Twitter since then is just, you know, keep your mouth shut, Parky. You don't know what you're talking about, you wee man. You wee bald man, you know, and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, default setting is kind of angry, isn't it? Especially after a few drams.
Who was it who said, he's some famous, it might have been something like George Orwell, but it wasn't, it was something like that. And he said, there's never any danger of mistaking a ray of sunlight and a Scotsman with a grudge.
Yeah, nice.
And he's absolutely like true, because, mind you, I mustn't say, I've got some great Scottish friends. I work with Scottish footballers. They're good people, you know.
They can't physically hack off that bit of this island.
No.
They can go and be independent if they like. See how they get on.
I don't want them to. It'll be disaster. The country will be disastrous. And what I say about the culture is, I've done a couple of Edinburgh festivals, and it's lovely being amongst the tartan and the Scottish culture and the pipe bands and all that kind of stuff, you know. And I hope they don't. I don't want the union to split up anyway. So that's another reason.
Well, we can still go to the Edinburgh festival if they're independent.
Yeah.
You know, it just costs more.
I like Glasgow as well. I love Socky Hall Street.
I love Glasgow.
I've done live shows in Socky Hall Street. That's quite an experience, believe me, at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know.
I did the I Write Festival, A-Y-E Write Festival.
What's that?
It's a book festival.
Oh, I see.
I did that last March.
Oh, okay.
Coming up this time last year.
Okay.
They were so welcoming. Yeah, it was lovely. Yeah. Lovely place.
Mind you, I there was another lady working on me. Working with me.
Who are you, Mick Jagger?
No. On the Jeremy Vine show. And her name is Beverly Turner, right?
Oh, yeah. We know Bev.
And do you know Bev?
Yeah.
And she was married to, is it Cracknell? James Cracknell? The rower.
Yes.
Yeah, remember? And sadly, he got whacked by the wing mirror of a lorry when he was cycling across America, didn't he? And it did cause him some personality problems. But Bev didn't talk about anything about that. She's a delightful company. Another lady called Ashley somebody, who was a DJ, great DJ.
I saw the picture.
Yeah, that's right. But what Beverly did is, Beverly is a fierce Remainer, and we were talking, you know, in the aftermath of us leaving Europe, and a lady came on who was a listener, and Beverly put to her that her life hadn't changed one iota the morning after we left Europe.
Not yet.
Well, that's the point. That's the point everybody's making. We've still got the year to sort it all out. And, you know, when you have a general election, nothing changes the next morning, does it? You see what I mean? And all that.
It's all a bit of a letdown, isn't it? It's all a bit of a letdown.
A bit of a letdown, I suppose, yeah. But Beverly was...
The morning
you know,
after anything is a bit of
Beverly
a letdown,
Beverly was quite an insistent Remainer, and the lady... So Beverly managed to set up to upset half the country, who are Brexiteers, OK? I managed to upset the whole of Scotland, you know, because of putting them down. So there's not much of the country left who was on my side or Beverly's by
London
the end of the show.
London is on your side, Sir Porky.
I would hope so. Right, now then, Leslie Ann, good to see you again. And, you know, you and I may have a tincture perhaps after the recording.
Tincture always goes down well.
Today. But one thing I want to talk to you about, right, and this is something which I have increasingly noticed as we move towards this sort of age bracket. Some 47% of people now admitted for alcohol-related reasons over the last 12 months were aged between 55 and 74, right? I think it's a growing phenomenon that people in that age bracket are taking to drink for two reasons. Firstly, it's very hard to accept retirement. You and I will probably never retire because we work for ourselves and we've always got things to do. But somebody who comes to the end of that, you know, job cycle at the age of 67 or something like that, then you're out and then they've got nothing to do. But the second thing is, that generation into which I will move in a decade or something like that, right, they've got money because they'd had pensions and they're good pensions, gold-plated pensions, and they own their houses and they can take wealth out of their houses. And do you know what I see, Leslie? And you won't because you're a lady and ladies don't hang around in pubs all day, you know? And I don't hang around in pubs all day. But generally speaking, when I finished work in London or I've been working somewhere else, some other city, or I'm down in Surrey, I go for a drink in the afternoon sometimes because we start very early doing breakfast. And in every pub I go into these days, there's a collection of upper middle-aged men who sit around and drink all day. And they're there if I go in at 11 o'clock in the morning, and they're there if I go in at 7 o'clock at night. And that's happened in every city I've visited over the last 2 or 3 years. My hometown, Chester, Liverpool, Manchester, certainly in London, Belfast I've been in. And I've seen this happen, and it's a growing phenomenon. But ladies can't do that, can they?
No, we can't. I mean, it's unseemly, isn't it,
to go and sit in a pub? Well, I have seen some women now. Increasingly, I've noticed over the last 6 months, women seem to, of that age, seem to want to just go and have a drink, you know?
Because if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander.
Yeah.
And why shouldn't you?
Yeah.
My best friend from school, Julie, works in a pub in Salisbury.
Oh, right.
And so she sees it around the clock.
Yeah.
And there is a phenomenon, which is a growing one, I think, of these men who have lost their jobs.
Yes.
But haven't told her indoors.
Oh, I see.
Pretend they're still going to work.
Really?
And they sit there in their suit and tie all
really?
Day long, and that's their office.
Yeah.
And they're on the phone and they're doing various things, probably trying to find jobs.
Yeah.
And then they go home as if they've been to work.
Really?
And that is frightening.
Golly. I've seen that happen in, like, you know, TV shows and all that kind of stuff. I didn't realise anybody actually still did
sure
that.
Oh, for sure it's happening for real. But I also think that generation, it's not that they've really taken up drinking in later life.
Yeah.
It's that they've always been drinking.
Because the
drinking culture was very big in our day on Fleet Street. We were always drunk, pretty much every day.
Well, we had to open our own club to make sure we didn't go short to drink in the afternoons. It was called the City Golf Club. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, goodness.
I mean, people forget
I know every corner of that club and it doesn't even exist anymore.
It doesn't. It's a gym palace now.
Yeah.
It's literally a
Wasn't
gym
it
palace.
Good, though?
Oh, it was brilliant. But
I had a special dress I used to put on to go in
there. Yeah. Well, people forget that between 3 o'clock and 5:30 in the days when we were young reporters on Fleet Street,
pubs were closed.
Well, they were closed to the general public. They were never closed to us, of course.
Lock-ins.
Oh, of course, the lock-ins all the time. But the lock-ins then started to become vulnerable. The City of London Police got wise to it. So we literally applied for a licence for a golf club.
Amazing we got the licence.
Exactly. And this golf club was in an alleyway, or more or less an alleyway.
Underneath St Bride's.
Going down to St Bride's, that's right, just off Fleet Street. And we got the licence to open a golf club in the centre of Fleet Street.
There was nothing golf about it.
There was no golf in it. There was nothing. I think
it was all a hole-in-one, though, wasn't it?
It certainly was. But initially, they got one of those screens in where you could wave a golf club at a screen and it was simulating playing golf, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Just in case an inspector ever came round and said, where's the golf course, you know
Brilliant
what I mean?
Brilliant idea.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. But generally speaking, of course, it was
Long
just
lamented.
It was just a massive drinking...
Oh, it all went on down there.
Oh, it was incredible.
I saw, you know, there was one, a famous female journalist, we better not name her.
Yeah.
You would see her on 5 days of the week sitting on a different male lap every afternoon.
Really?
She really got around.
Really?
I have to say, I quite looked up to her.
Did you?
I didn't have the nerve for that kind of thing in those days.
The point is, the bosses approved of it because if they knew you were in the golf club, and they had a bank of phones installed so that there was never just one telephone line that was engaged because the reporter was talking to his desk, they had about half a dozen phones, you know, and people worked out of there. And photographers in particular, because photographers don't have a lot to do a lot of the time. You know that, don't you?
They follow us around.
They follow us around. Or if nothing's happened, it hasn't been a disaster or anything like that, they can't find anything to do. And Fleet Street was massively overstaffed in those days, and what news editors and picture editors wanted was somewhere to send their people to get them out the newsroom in case the editor walked through.
Because you weren't following a story. You couldn't do the job sitting there, could you?
Exactly. I mean, the editors knew what was going on, but if the proprietor, for instance, walked through, you know, if Lord Fingers, who owned the Daily Express in those days, walked through and saw all these people sitting around doing nothing, he'd want to know why. He didn't understand that, well, actually, you need 30 reporters when an aeroplane crashes on the M1, but you don't need any reporters to go and report on Paul McCartney's wedding at Chelsea Town Hall Register Office. You know what I mean? You only need one. And they didn't understand that. But, yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, some people I knew lived in the City Golf Club, literally would kip down on the couches overnight and still be there the next morning when it opened again at 11 o'clock.
Oh,
you
I
know
slept
what I
mean? In the Groucho Club a few times after that opened.
The Groucho have bedrooms, though, don't they?
Yeah, they do now, but they didn't in those days. But we would not, you know, it wasn't about bedding down for the night.
Yes.
You would just kind of slide under the armchair you were sitting
in. Yes,
at the
that's
time.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And then the next morning, go and buy a toothbrush, walk up to Topshop, buy a new shirt, go straight to work.
No, I've done that before myself. That started in Manchester, by the way, when I worked at the Daily Express in Manchester on Great Ancoat Street. And the building there now, the Black Blue Bianca, is now a listed building, and it has offices in it and all that kind of stuff. It's a beautiful
building.
They don't
know the ghosts. We know the ghosts.
Oh, they know the ghosts. But the printing press is still there on the ground floor.
Wonderful.
You know, you can see it through the window. It's absolutely beautiful. But there was a pub opposite called the Land of Cakes, right? Nobody knows why it was called the
Great
Land of
name.
Cakes. We used to call it the Lando. And the pub next door was the Crown and Kettle. Now, the Land of Cakes had two rooms upstairs. But, I mean, not rooms. They were rooms with a flat bed in it with no covers or anything
shagging
like that.
Shagging dens?
Yeah, sort of. But,
oh,
but it wasn't a lot of shagging going on. This was for the boys who simply couldn't get home through...
And couldn't stand up anymore.
Couldn't stand up, inebriation, and they charged 50p a night on the slip. Yeah, I'm not joking. And
I would have paid them.
Yeah, exactly. And by about sort of 10 o'clock, you had to think to yourself, I wonder if I've got to book the room. Because there were only two, and the first two who paid up their 50p got the room. Although some nights, you'd get three blokes in one room. You know, they're all so pissed.
Gross.
It'd be a leaving do or something like that. But they'd get
that
up the next morning and go back to work. No, it doesn't matter.
How
thinking.
Did we drink so much? I can remember.
I don't know.
You know, when morning conference, which was just before 11 o'clock on the Daily Mail when I was there. So the minute they all flung into morning conference, we'd all be over the wine press.
Yes, that's right.
You know, bottle of wine.
Yes.
Back, do a bit more work, see what stories were going on, and then out.
Yes.
And then it would be lunch, two more bottles of wine.
Yeah, I
totally
agree.
And then for me, in the evening, it would usually be at least a gig, at least a launch of some kind,
totally
if not
agree.
More. And then somebody's party, on and on and on.
Yep.
Another bottle of wine. So we were doing like four bottles of wine and a few gin and tonics every single day.
I know. It was,
how are we alive?
It was unbelievable. I don't know. Well, that's why the NUJ Pension Fund is one of the wealthiest in the country. Nobody got to the age of payout, you know, which was like 65 or something. Most people died in their 50s, you know.
But well, I had to give up because I was pregnant.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was always a big thing about no alcohol during pregnancy.
Sure, sure.
And I never regained my capacity.
No.
My Fleet Street capacity.
No, okay.
And I look back on those days with great affection.
I can't believe how much we used to drink. I totally agree with you. And by the way...
We must have been pickled, I think.
Oh, it must have been. I mean, if mobile phones had been around in those days, none of us would have had a job left.
No.
I mean, mobile phones are so dangerous in drink. I've fallen foul of it a number of times, you know, to my detriment. And if they'd been around in those days...
What, you send dodgy text messages?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, do you?
Not text messages, tweet messages.
Oh, you put the stuff out publicly.
Tweets out. Yeah,
oh,
that's right.
I got suspended from the Groucho Club for that.
Really? Yeah, yeah. Well, that's,
and quite
that's
rightly,
the problem.
So
And text sometimes. I tell people what I think of them, you know.
I don't do that. Save it till the morning.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. If you can save it till the morning.
It's
I'm
like writing the dodgy letter, isn't it, to a lover or something. But don't post it.
Don't post it, that's
tear
right.
Tear it up the next day and go, oh, no.
But I had a news editor, a guy called John Jinks, okay? And I think Johnny's about 80 now, and nobody quite knows where he is. I think he shuffled off to one of these journalists' old people's homes down in Surrey.
They usually die in there.
Yeah, Horsham or somewhere like that.
Yeah, I wouldn't live in a place
like that. And I haven't seen him for years. John was my...
Joe Allen would be where we end up.
Say again.
Joe Allen would be where we end up.
John would be where we end up, absolutely, yeah. But Johnny was... He first of all was my boss. He was the news editor. Then I went off to America. By the time I came back, I took his job. He was sacked and I got the job as news editor, which wasn't terribly friendly. But then we became good friends. He then became news editor of The Times.
He went up in the world.
Well, absolutely. He got a... He went through a divorce, and going through the divorce, he had no way to live. He came and stayed with me, okay, for about 3 or 4 months. Very, very funny 3 or 4 months we had. You know, we were both bachelors then, you know what I mean? He was separated from
God.
And that was great stuff. But his routine as news editor, when I first got there, so opened my eyes to the way Fleet Street worked, because I was such a keen reporter. I'd get in about 7:30 in the morning, you know, waiting for the big job and the big story to break, and I get out there. John used to come in at about... Morning conference was 10 o'clock. John used to come in about 20 to 10, and he was always hungover. He used to womanise incessantly and tell his wife that he was staying in a hotel in London, big editorial meetings and all that kind of stuff. But he'd come in about 20 to 10. He had a half-bake of a deputy called Mike somebody. I can't remember his name now. And Mike's job was to make sure the news list was done by the time John got in, you know. And John would go into conference at 10 o'clock, And first of all, the first editor he had was Larry Lamb, Sir Larry Lamb,
oh.
who was the biggest drunk on the paper.
Oh, wasn't he?
I mean, did you work at the Sun when Sir Larry was there?
No, I was Calvin Hyde.
Oh, right, OK, yeah. Well, I worked at the Express when Sir Larry was there after he came from the Sun, and he was an inveterate drunk. I mean, he could barely stand up by midday, honestly. And in those days, we had these corridors in this old-fashioned Express building with metal lockers either side. And you knew when the editor was coming because you had this boom, boom, boom.
He
would
staggering.
Bounce from side to side
oh my God.
The corridor and come in. So
you'd be fired for that nowadays, wouldn't
oh,
you?
Oh, yeah, completely. So John would get into conference at 10 and Larry would offer drinks to anybody who wanted one. And John would always take one. Some of the others would, some wouldn't, and that kind of stuff.
Start as we mean to go
on. Yeah, start as we mean to go on the day. You're absolutely right. And then conference was over about 10:30. Well, a real conference should take about an hour. This should take about half an hour to get out. And then John was straight down the stairs into the Popinjay, which was in the same building.
And all the newspapers had their own pub.
Yeah, they all had their
and
own pub.
And you weren't supposed to stray into else's territory.
Well, not till the evening, obviously.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely
and
right.
Their stories.
So John would go down, knock on the door. The landlady ran it, was a friend of all of the Express staff. So John got in there about 10:30. And then we had about 6 deputy news editors or assistant news editors would then go down in rotation. You see what I mean? First one would go with John and then he'd come back half an hour later. Another 2 would go down and they'd come back at midday. And then John would manage to get into the back into the newsroom about 10:50, just in time to go out for lunch and check with Mike, whatever his name was. What was his name? Mike Steamson, I think his name was.
Okay.
Yeah, he was a very nice guy, but he was put upon terribly, you know, by the bosses. And John would take a progress report off Mike. So, okay, great. And then all he had to do then was get back by 4:00 for evening conference. John usually got back about 3:30, right? Ran through a few stories, you know, tried to, you know, because he's always pissed, tried to see them. And then evening conference would end at about 4:30, and then it was all back to the pub. That was it. That was the working day.
Well, the first edition was out at about 6:00 in those days.
It wasn't, actually. Funny enough, because it was old, hot lead, it was much later. It was about 7:30, 8:00.
But the trucks that were heading north, because the papers were
printed
in the basement of the building, I can remember those trucks rolling out.
To the stations.
Going
you know,
home,
right.
Time for the secretaries. Yeah, to the stations,
to the stations to put them on the trains off. But
anyway.
Put the story is, Johnny, I think, is nearly 80 now. I think he was 13 years older than me. So he's not quite 80, is he?
He's done well if he's
his low 70s. Yeah, I think he has. But that was just what it was. You know, it was, it literally floated on a lake of beer and wine.
Different times.
And some of the states, the reports got in. There's a guy called Michael O'Flaherty, who I've spoken about before, a very genial Irishman, you know, terribly charming, married 5 times. Every time he met a woman.
Oh, he was that genial, was he?
Yeah.
Okay.
But every time he met a woman, he fell in love with her, you know, and he divorced his previous wife and then get married again. The last woman he married was an African princess. He ended up living in a mud hut, literally. That's not a joke. He you know, towards the end of his life, he got this sort of God complex. So he decided to go to Africa and do some voluntary service overseas, you know. So he goes off to do that, and he literally meets an African princess, you know, the daughter of an African chief. He married her, and he died about 6 months later. But Michael used
to put a spell on him.
Michael used to come in after lunch sometimes, having been in the pub since 10:30 in the morning. Absolutely fouled mouth, go into bosses' offices, tell them to F off, you know, and how they didn't know anything about newspapers. He would wreck offices and all sorts of things, you know, kick chairs over and all that. But nobody ever got sacked, because it's a bit like why politicians don't always dwell on the opposition scandals, because if you dwell too much on the opposition scandals, they'll come and find yours. And believe me, everybody of every rank was at it in Fleet Street. And although there were no, you know, industrial tribunals in those days, they couldn't possibly sack somebody for being pissed when everybody else was pissed.
Exactly.
You'd have to sack the whole office, you know.
Oh, I miss it, don't you?
Yeah, I do miss it a bit. But you know, those are those days. It doesn't happen like it is now. All the young journalists that we deal with now in Fleet Street wear suits and ties if they're men, and they're very smartly dressed
what,
in
now?
Suits if they're women. Yeah.
No, they don't.
They do.
I've been out on, well, not yeah. on. I remember, maybe we've talked about this before, Rupert Murdoch's wedding with Jerry Hall.
Oh,
well,
yes.
It wasn't actually a wedding. It was a blessing
yes.
at St. Bride's Church.
Yes.
And I was there that day,
yeah.
and the pack who turned up. In our day, right, we
yeah.
go out on a job. We always had to come to work.
Yeah.
As if we could go to a wedding or a funeral.
Right.
So a little black dress,
yeah,
pearls,
sure, sure.
you guys would be in suits and ties.
Yeah.
Everybody looked very smart
yeah.
and clean and presentable.
Yeah.
This lot
yeah.
just looked like a bunch of students dragged
really?
Off a campus.
Well, they probably were. They're probably interns.
With backpacks on and ladders up.
Probably
and,
interns.
Yeah, but they were a mess. And I thought, you guys cannot come into church
no.
looking like this.
No, okay.
So you can't take them anywhere anymore. Journalists let the side down now, I think.
Yeah, but they get paid nothing these days, so
yeah,
they can't probably can't even afford clothes.
Can't afford
when
new
I
shoes.
When I was in Fleet Street, I was paid 15 grand a year, my first stint as a reporter on the Express, and bought my first flat in London for 30 grand.
Yeah.
So you were earning enough to finance 50% of your property, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Just imagine trying that today.
We flew everywhere, club class,
yes,
if not
did.
First, if not Concorde.
Yes, we did. Yeah.
We stayed five star.
Yes.
You know, we always turned,
oh, he's brilliant.
We turned left on a plane more times than we didn't.
Oh,
did
absolutely.
And we drank champagne and we
did.
Lived the high life.
And then
the point being that yeah. we had to live as the celebrities were living.
Yes, that's
in
right.
In order to get close to
well,
them.
Of course you did. If the celebrity was on Concorde, you had to get on Concorde with him and fly over to...
Baz
Bamigboy used to use Concorde all the time.
Yeah.
He used to con all his bosses. Not, I don't mean that seriously, Baz. You're a terrific operator, mate.
Love
working
you,
with you here and in America. But you know, Baz would tip somebody the wing that somebody's jumping on the Concorde and off to New York. You know, Jagger or somebody like that. You know, well, you better get after him then. You know, and it was
worked
classic.
Every time.
Classic. It was.
It's very noisy on that plane.
Yeah.
I mean, you couldn't record anything.
No, I agree. And you couldn't even stand up if you were tall.
No, that's true.
I agree. Right. Okay. Well, listen, Leslie Ann, been a pleasure to work with you as ever. You know, if you recollect. Of Fleet Street there and a few bit of the glamour that goes on in our world. Thank you very much indeed. Everybody out there, thank you as well. Remind us of your Twitter handle, please, Leslie Ann.
At LAJ Writer.
At LAJ Writer. I am Mike Parry 8. You can get hold of us on planetporkypod@gmail.com. Look at that.
Hooray,
first time.
First
got it right.
Time.
Send us a message. Let us know what you think. And we'll be back with you again very soon. Some of the states, the report's gone in. There's a guy called Michael O'Flaherty, who I've spoken about before, a very genial Irishman, you know, terribly charming, married five times. Every time he met a woman...
Oh, he was that genial, was he?
Yeah.
Okay.
But every time he met a woman, he fell in love with her, you know, and he divorced his previous wife and then get married again. The last woman he married was an African princess. He ended up living in a mud hut, literally. That's not a joke. He towards the end of his life, he got this sort of god complex, so he decided to go to Africa and do some voluntary service overseas, you know? So... He goes off to do that, and he literally meets an African princess, you know, the daughter of an African chief. He married her, and he died about 6 months later. But Michael...
She put a spell on him.
Michael used to come in after lunch sometimes, having been in a pub since 10:30 in the morning. Absolutely fouled mouth, going to bosses' offices, telling them to F off, you know, and how they didn't know anything about newspapers. He would wreck offices and all sorts of things, you know, kick chairs over and all that. But nobody ever got sacked, because it's a bit like why politicians don't always dwell on the opposition's scandals. Because if you dwell too much on the opposition's scandals, they'll come and find yours. And believe me, everybody of every rank was at it in Fleet Street. Keep your mouth shut, Porky. You don't know what you're talking about, you wee man. You wee bald man.